Good afternoon. Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 27, 2016. Time is 1:30 p.m. Members present are Representatives Wilson, Guerra, Pruitt, Kawasaki, Sadler, Co-Chair Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Gaddis. I do expect the other members shortly. First, we're going to hear a half-hour overview from the Mental Health Trust Authority. Then we'll hear from the Health and Social Services Department overview. So starting with that, so hopefully by 2 o'clock, Jeff. So I guess we'll get on with business. Jeff Jesse.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Russ Webb, for the record. I am the chairman of the board of the Mental Health Trust Authority Board of Trustees. With me today, on my right, is a well-known figure, Jeff Jesse. On my left, who is the chief executive officer of the trust. On my left is John Morrison, who is the executive director of the trust land office. I brought each of them with me today because they're both much smarter and better looking than I am, and in Jeff's case, he's far more silver-tongued and he'll do a much better job at presenting, so we'll start with that. I'd like to begin by saying I'm really pleased to be here and certainly pleased to be here in this role. The Trust is a great organization, as you know. I'd be much more pleased to be here if oil was $120 a barrel and we were pumping a million gallons a day through the pipeline, but I do recall from my years as Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services when for most of that time oil was under $20 a barrel, but the good part was we were pumping a lot of it. So I'm not unfamiliar with the difficulties. I'd like to introduce the trustees who are here. Mary Jane Michael is the Vice Chair of the Trust. Larry Noreen is the Secretary Treasurer. Lorraine Durr, who I'm sure many of you know. Paula Easley, also well-known, and Carlton Smith, doubtless equally well-known. I'd also like to acknowledge that we have a new trustee as of yesterday, Jerome Selby, who I think many of you know. He is from Kodiak. He has much experience here and familiar with many of you likely and the process. He's not able to be here today, but we look forward to him being with us in the future. I'd also like to introduce the executive directors of our advisory boards, Kate Burkhart with the Alaska Mental Health Board and Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Kate is in the room. Nope. Denise Daniello from the Alaska Commission on Aging, and I think Patrick Reinhart from the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education is here. Before turning it over to Jeff, I'll just briefly give you some idea of the magnitude of our trust beneficiaries. I think you can see we've got an estimate of over 34,000 Alaskans with a mental illness, 13,000 with developmental disability, 20,000 with chronic alcoholism or a substance-related disorder, 6,000, and probably as Denise pointed out to us earlier, growing quickly with Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, and 11,000 with a traumatic brain injury.
Thank you. Mr. Webb, we have a question from Representative Gaddis.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at those numbers, are there any of the do we have that many in each of those categories, or do some of them wear a couple different hats? How many people are we actually serving in that?
Representative Gaddis, through the chair, these are numbers of beneficiaries, not necessarily all getting service, but you're absolutely correct. Not the number served in the various programs. This is an estimate of the number of beneficiaries in the population. Each of the programs will serve a different number, but you're absolutely right. There are many of our beneficiaries who have co-occurring conditions. I don't think we have a precise number of that. Jeff?
No, I don't. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Trust Authority. Representative Gaddis, through the chair, no, we don't know exactly how many people with co-occurring disorders there are, but you're right. There is definitely overlap between all of these different categories.
If I may? And so in the numbers that you've related here, even though there may be I think the word is co-occurrence that you indicated, are any of these numbers here overlapping one another? What I'm really trying to determine is you have 84,000 that you're showing here. Could there possibly be, you know, far less than that because they have co-occurrences, as you indicate?
Representative Gaddis, through the chair, there is overlap. It could be lower, but it's not dramatically lower. These are mostly where these are the primary diagnoses. And it's synthetic national data. We don't have a way of actually counting beneficiaries in Alaska.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I guess, you know, I mean, we're putting the numbers out there, but we really, and I see where it says approximate. And so that's just an interesting, I hadn't thought about it, and I'll have to think about it a little bit more. Maybe I'll get with you later to try to see how we get to that number.
But sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just briefly, I'll let you know, some years ago, as you probably all know, the Trust established areas of specific focus for significant and sustained investment over time to try to make a big difference in a number of different areas. I'll go through briefly the established focus areas that we have. Disability justice, which really is focused on our beneficiaries who are involved with the criminal justice system. Substance abuse prevention and treatment, beneficiary employment and engagement, workforce development, and housing and long-term services and supports. And Jeff, I'll turn it over to you and let you.
And members, just in the matter of time management, Representative Thompson has a question, but then after that, if we can hold our questions to after the presentation, I want to make sure we get all this information out.
I would just, thank you. I was just wondering, of the beneficiaries that you have here, how many of those people are incarcerated in prisons at the present time out of these?
On any given day, it can be up to 65% of the correctional population. Over the course of a year, it's about 40% of the corrections population are trust beneficiaries.
Thank you. Thank you.
Moving on to our current priorities, they are very straightforward and simple and exigent, which is our priority is to help you build a sustainable budget. Our beneficiaries are very impacted by what you do in terms of your budget. If you can't build a sustainable budget, then our beneficiaries aren't going to have access to the services that they need. The two main areas where we see tremendous opportunity, not only for savings that can build a more sustainable budget, but where the trust could play a positive role in partnering with you, is in Medicaid redesign and in justice reinvestment. Those are two major budget areas that we think are also interrelated in a very significant way. And that's why the trust has identified these as our two current priorities. You can see, starting at the bottom, by using behavioral health system reform, and however you may individually feel about Medicaid expansion, it is a huge opportunity from a programmatic standpoint and a budget standpoint to do the kind of redesign and reinvestment that needs to be done in order to bring these budget areas under better control.
And, you know, the question, of course, would be the obvious question, why does the trust care so much about Medicaid redesign? Why are we so engaged in it? And from my own history, I'll tell you, when I worked for the Department of Health and Social Services more than 20 years ago, we had already begun at $8 a barrel oil pursuing a strategy to refinance the services that were funded with general funds only with Medicaid, and in part to gain the benefit of the federal match and cut down on the general fund costs. That's been going on for more than 20 years now, and it's a strategy that the state as a whole has continued to pursue with, I think, everyone's blessing. The systems that have been in place to serve trust beneficiaries are now primarily Medicaid-funded. The Medicaid services represent the biggest portion of our comprehensive integrated mental health system of care. So we are absolutely committed to the sustainability of the Medicaid program. It has to be sustainable or services will fall apart for our trust beneficiaries. There are things, opportunities now that didn't exist when we first began on Medicaid refinancing to change the way services are structured to get better outcomes. That's the redesign piece. There are ways to gain greater federal participation. That's part of the redesign process. We just have to make Medicaid work, and we have to make it work better. There are, because of the way the federal program is structured, there are a number of things that have prevented us from making absolutely the best use of the Medicaid dollars. For example, when we refinanced services with Medicaid, some folks became ineligible. In our behavioral health system, that meant that there were critical populations, young men at high risk for involvement with the criminal justice system, in many respects because of their substance use disorders, traumatic brain injuries, mental illnesses, who could not access service because they couldn't get through the Medicaid door. So some of the services have fallen off. So we've got to make our system work for getting the outcomes that we need and make it work at a sustainable level.
So how are we doing that? How are we partnering with the department and with you to help this process move along? Well, the trustees have invested over $600,000 just this year in efforts to try to help promote this movement and this process. And we realize this isn't going to be a short-term effort. And it isn't that we're starting from ground zero. I mean, the department has already been in the process of looking at reforms and other ways of transforming our Medicaid system. We're just going to have to accelerate that process as we continue down the road. So we know it's a long haul, but we're used to that. You know, we bridge administrations, we bridge legislatures. Bring the Kids Home was an 8-year effort across three different administrations. So we're used to that. So we're committed to assisting in this. What did we do with that money? Well, for example, one thing we did was assist by getting a technical assistance contract to look at a Medicaid reform from a national perspective. One of the things we did is retain the services of Charlie Curry. Charlie Curry was the former director of the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration under the Bush administration. And he, while he was SAMHSA director, he took a particular interest in Alaska, unlike many federal officials at that high level, and actually went out to rural Alaska and spent time up here. And so he's very familiar with Alaska. And we've retained him and his associates to, now that he's a consultant in private practice, consulting with many states across the country as they go through Medicaid reform. He's now available to us to particularly in the areas of behavioral health, to look at, you know, what can we do? What can lessons can we take from other places that we can adapt and use in Alaska? And he's been very helpful to both the trust and to the department as well. So a number of reforms are already under consideration. Now, this doesn't mean all these things are going to happen or they're all going to happen at once, but just to give you an idea of what's out there. There are state plan options for home and community-based services that we're looking into with the department. Primary care access initiative. We know that are especially around our beneficiaries. If we can integrate services into primary care, they're going to get better service sooner at a lower cost. So getting primary care on board with our beneficiaries is a very high priority. The Behavioral Health Access Initiative. I don't think I have to tell anyone here that access to behavioral health services is a problem. But we can't throw money at it, so we have to figure out a way to be more effective and more efficient. Data analytics and IT infrastructure. If we can't collect and analyze the data about these reforms as they're taking place, then it's not going to work. I mean, that's what we learned with Bring the Kids Home. Nothing works exactly the way you draw it up on paper. You have to keep following the data, analyzing it, looking at why you're not getting all the results the way you thought you were going to get them, and making changes along the way. Accountable care organizations, looking at how we can start really managing care. That's going to be critical to saving money, and looking at alternative benefit plans for the expansion population. These are all things that are already being looked at. There are many more, and this is one of the challenges that we have, is there are a lot of moving parts right now. We've got Senator Kelly's bill. We've got the House bill. We've got a bill from Representative Hawker. We've got at least two major reports, one that LB&A commissioned, one that the department with financial help from the trust was able to help with. Somehow, in this session, these have to get put together into a Medicaid reform bill. We need a bill that you can pass and the governor will sign. So anything that we can do along the way to facilitate that process, we're certainly willing to do so. But that is absolutely critical, to get a bill out of here this year so that the department has some of the tools that they're going to need in order to continue to move forward in this area. I know that just this morning, I believe Senate Finance has appointed a subcommittee to look at the different bills and reports and see if they can't start putting something together on their side. So we just wanted to highlight that. And then, of course, the other major area of priority is justice reinvestment.
And, again, why is that important to us? For the precise reason that Representative Thompson asked about. 40% or a little over 40% of the folks, the population of the Department of Corrections over the course of the last 4 years have been trust beneficiaries. In some institutions, it's as high as 75%. And on any given day, and we had a one-day count, 65% on that one day were trust beneficiaries. What's critical about that is trust beneficiaries spend longer in our prison system. For felons, they remain in jail twice as long. I believe for misdemeanors, it's more than 2.5 times as long. The recidivism rates for trust beneficiaries are twice as high as for non-trust beneficiaries. In order to be, and you've also, I think, probably seen the governor's report on the Department of Corrections relating to some deaths that occurred in the Department of Corrections, some of which were trust beneficiaries. The most recent death in Anchorage, the victim was a trust beneficiary, as was the perpetrator. And in the case of the victim, he shouldn't have been there at all. He was under a Title 47 hold. Held because of either an alcohol or mental illness and lack of an alternative placement at the time. So we want and have been working for a long time on trying to get services in place to prevent people from getting into the criminal justice system. If they get in, to help them get out, be served well, treated well, be safe and get out as quickly as possible, and then we have to have services in the community for them to succeed and stay out. So justice reinvestment is critical for us.
And you've heard me talk about this many times before. Okay, so we've got these beneficiaries. They get tied up in the criminal justice system. They get out. How are we going to keep them from going back? We've got to stop them from going back. And again, it's the three-legged stool. They've got to have housing. They've got to have employment. And they've got to have support for recovery. The reason that these things work well together is that there's a critical intersection between criminal justice reform and Medicaid expansion and redesign, particularly around trust beneficiaries. I mean, you know some of the obvious savings, the ability now to, when corrections sends an inmate to a hospital, to get them signed up for Medicaid and have the federal government basically pay most of that bill instead of the general fund, which is what you're doing now. But then many other parts of this also are dependent upon looking at Medicaid as a way of funding a lot of these pieces. The department is being very proactive in working with the federal government and getting some flexibility in our Medicaid program that can really help on this justice reinvestment side. So that's a great partnership between the department and the other players in the justice reinvestment arena, and we're very positive about that. So what's next? Well, these are all the things that have happened or are ongoing. And I just want to mention that it was over 2 years ago, before the price of oil collapsed, that there was really, frankly, a visionary moment in this committee where you, well, the co-chair, placed intent language into the budget that for the first time started to draw together not just the usual criminal justice suspects, but AHFC, the Department of Labor, the Mental Health Trust, and that was really, in my mind, the beginning of a lot of this visioning of how we could change the criminal justice system. And so the recidivism reduction plan, which was then further developed when the co-chair put additional intent language in the budget last year, really has set the stage and started the momentum in this whole arena. And then, of course, the price of oil collapse has just made it all the more exigent. But thankfully, we got actually quite a good head start in this area, thanks to this committee. The DOC, Department of Corrections, has their own reentry initiative. I'm not going to go through. You know about the Pew Public Safety Initiative and the Justice Reinvestment Project, the Criminal Justice Commission, where I serve and was here earlier in the week to talk about. SB 91, Senator Coghill's bill, which hopefully will be incorporating as many of those recommendations as possible. And then our joint funding, which also, by the way, came out of this committee, our joint funding of the Alaska Justice Information Center so that we can collect and analyze the data about the justice reforms as we go. So once again, we can be data-driven and be thoughtful about how we evolve this justice system. So hopefully you can see how these two things are integrally related, Medicaid reform and justice reinvestment. One of the things I want to talk about is our long-term funding strategy. One thing that I hear a lot in the building is, well, you know, that mental health trust, those guys are great at starting something up, and then, you know, shoot, a lot of times it works, and then they come in here and they want us to fund it through general funds, and that creates a challenge. Well, we do some of that. That's one of the real values of the trust, is that you have a venture capital fund that can actually try some ideas and see what works. But a lot of our funding also goes for long-term ongoing projects, and I just wanted to make that point today. As you can see, MTAR, the money that comes through the state budget, 39% of our total budget that we spend comes through the state government on a long-term basis. 25% of our authority grants, that money that we grant directly to the community without coming through the state budget process, 25% of our total funding in that area is long-term. So 65% of our funding is committed to long-term support of programs. It's not just about the next shiny thing. It's also about supporting some key parts of the mental health program that for one reason or another, you know, it's better for us to do it than to try to convince you or other entities to try to fund these things on a long-term basis. Now, we certainly recognize that this year is a huge challenge as far as the budget. The trustees recognize that, and so our FY17 operating increments comes down to one thing. And the one thing that we're trying to get into the budget this year is IT and telehealth system improvement. And why is that the one thing that we're trying to bring forward? Is because that's part of this effort to build a sustainable budget by using IT and telemedicine to reduce costs. The more that we can do to serve people remotely without having to fly people around and spend that time and energy just moving around is huge. Now, the capital budget, if you remember from last year, this capital budget isn't your normal bricks and mortar. You know, most of this money is not for constructing things. The homeless assistance program, special needs housing program, many of those funds are for ongoing operating. They're granted annually for three-year periods. So this is absolutely critical that the capital budget stay in the budget, because it amounts to a pretty critical safety net for the most vulnerable beneficiaries, something that, of course, I know is a concern to many of you. To sort of back up and look at the big picture of the trust, this just gives you an idea of our total cash assets at the end of FY15. The endowment's now grown to $550 million. You can see that that's a combination of the original settlement, our inflation proofing. The trust land office has contributed almost $100 million into the corpus of the fund. The real estate portion, unrealized appreciation, and of course the most critical part of our fiscal matrix is the budget reserves. That's the income reserve that when we have a recession and the market's doing poorly and the permanent fund's not making any money, that's how we can continue to make the payout. And of course the trust uses a percentage of market value strategy rather than relying on income or profit or loss from year to year and having a very uneven income stream. We use a percentage of market value strategy. Currently, it's at 4.25%. Looking at FY17, this is what our anticipated income looks like. You can see the payout at about $20 million. Our prior year's average lapse is a little over $3 million. By the way, that's a difference in how we operate. If an agency doesn't use all of the money that we've given them, that comes back into the fund and is available for reallocation by the trustees in future years. The land office, average spendable income is over $4 million that's able to be added to the payout in order to provide these necessary services, and then a certain amount of interest for a total of almost $29 million a year. Here's a chart that shows you kind of our payout history. You can see how we started the payout at a fairly low level back when the trust was set up. That was largely because we had to build up the budget reserve over time. As we've built up the reserve and inflation proof, the trustees have been able to increase the payout, and you can see how the income from that has gone up as well.
A couple of things that we want to emphasize to you. We know that we're all in this together. As trustees, we recognize that it's our responsibility to do everything we can to help generate income that we can use to provide services and supports and the venture capital for trust beneficiaries. We have challenges. We've got 1 million acres of land, but we don't really have 1 million acres of land. We've got half of that, approximately, John, is subsurface rights only. And all of those, all of the impediments that hinder development of the resource base in our state apply. apply to the trust. We face those things just like the private sector does. We face it with the private sector, and we face some additional challenges that the private sector doesn't necessarily face. We have, as Jeff pointed out, had a good bit of principal and income generated by the trust land office. The trustees recognize that we have to do more. We've set a pretty ambitious goal for our trust land office. Today, trustees established a goal for our land office to generate an amount of spendable income that equals or exceeds the amount that we receive from the permanent fund, from our cash assets. We want to generate from our non-cash assets at least that much spendable income. We won't get there tomorrow, but we've asked John to develop a plan that can get us there over time as quickly as possible, but recognizing that it won't be overnight. Get us there within a reasonable period with interim goals along the way to make sure we're making progress. We're going to do more. And I've asked John here to talk a little bit about what we can do, what we have done, and give you sort of the framework for the Trust Land Office.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. This slide here is a representation of the income that the Trust Land Office has generated since inception in 95. You'll notice that in the 20 years since inception, the TLO has generated, in a combination of principal and income revenue, $180 million. The Trust Land Office mission is to maximize revenue for the trust, and in doing so, we make all of our decisions about our resources for those that are in the best interest of the trust and its beneficiaries. We have taken on the mantra to diversify, develop, and defend the trust assets and all that we do. Wanted to draw your attention to the left side of the graph from 1995 until roughly 2010, with 2011 being a pivotal year of change. Specifically note that the various colors represent income streams from different assets that the trust has. And the most notable thing is that the pink and green are representative of land transactions and timber transactions, both of which are non-repeatable events. So they were large cash contributions of mostly principal that were available to otherwise be invested, but it's important to note that once you have sold the land or cut the tree, it's gone. So beginning 2010, 2011, we took on an active engagement to diversify our income streams, specifically focusing on other areas where we could generate predictable, repeatable income revenue, which is much more difficult to come by than one-time infusions of principal from a sale of an asset. In that regard, over time we have developed from what one would consider a typical land office into now we are truly transforming and moving towards a sophisticated fixed asset model manager. Next slide. As way of an example, to reiterate, two key attributes. The darker shaded green color is our timber revenue since inception, as opposed to all other revenue in the lighter green color. A couple things to note here. One, a key part of our strategy moving forward has been something we've been working on many years with the Forest Service, which is the land exchange here in Southeast Alaska, representing roughly 20,000 acres of trust land across several communities for value for value exchange for roughly 20,000 acres of Forest Service land. It's key for two reasons. One, much of the land we are desiring to exchange is located in areas that, for one reason or another, is maybe not as marketable as we would like, and we would hope to trade that for other land, including trees, that would be marketable and harvestable. So two things. One, the land exchange will, in years to come, we do expect to come forward with legislation to move that exchange forward. So just to put that on your radar. But then in addition, just to reiterate that we at the Trust Land Office can't focus on any one resource base. As you can see, there was a time when timber was providing plenty of revenue, and those days are gone now. So next slide. Other slide, to a different representation of some of the information from the first slide, but it breaks it down into the differentiation between principal revenue represented in blue, which is the very spiky line, and then the income revenue, which is the green line. Thing I'd like to point out about the green line is it is always above the purple line, which is our operating expenses. And so we at the Trust Land Office do strive to specifically provide and have provided more income revenue than we have cost, and we feel we're providing great value to the trust and the responsible management of these assets. The last thing to note is that the green line for the income revenue is what we would like to call directionally correct, with a nice increase. So that's it.
Thank you for the time and attention. And if there are questions, we'll be happy to take them.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. I'll ask briefly one question. Jeff, in the past we had talked about how would it affect recidivism if we're able to get treatment after arrest. Can you give us your thoughts on that for trust authority?
Yeah, absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Yes, as you heard the other day, you know, we have a huge percentage of our prison and jail population are people that are pretrial. And many of them, most of them, have some kind of a substance abuse, usually alcohol, connection to the crime. If we could deliver treatment to those individuals at that point where many of them are highly motivated, either to get out of trouble or to stay out of trouble by getting sober, that would be a huge piece of long-term strategy to bring the criminal justice budgetary stability that you need. So absolutely, the more that we can do to get access to people before they end up even in trial, I think would be a huge step forward. Right now, we don't have the capacity to deliver that treatment even to those individuals that want it.
Thanks, Jeff. And then I think the next step in that, you know, and as you mentioned earlier, the first thing we tried to develop is a recidivism reduction plan. That followed in with working with the Pew, the beneficiaries' recommendations on that. I think probably the next step in that would be to work towards, be able to allow treatment after their arrest. A lot of times it's up to 2 years before somebody gets sentenced, before they can get treatment. And obviously this is voluntary treatment, but we're just trying to make opportunities, I think, to get access to when grabbing people by the collar before they fall in that river when they're feeling that remorse.
Absolutely.
Thank you. We'll start with Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Webb, you said, Dr. Webb, I'm sure, that you're not sure exactly of all the beneficiaries around the state. How many of your beneficiaries know they are, in fact, beneficiaries?
Those who are receiving services certainly know they're beneficiaries. And again, I can't give you the specific numbers for each of the various programs. We can certainly work with the department to get that information to you. I don't have it today. There are many, I suspect, who are either undiagnosed and don't know, or who may not be aware that even though they have a diagnosis, they are a trust beneficiary. How to count that, I could not possibly begin to tell you.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Gaddis, and then Gary and Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I debated whether to bring it up, but as co-chair was commenting about mental health within our prisons, I know that just very recently, certainly not one of my constituents, but in Goose Creek, and he wants me to be very vocal about this, and I promised him I would. He got out of prison less than a month ago. He's a military veteran. He knew he had PTSD issues. He knew that, and his biggest fear was, after getting out, he knew without mental health treatment that he was going back in, and he begged to get treatment. And, you know, certainly as a representative in my community, even though he's actually from Southeast, it was super difficult to find out where to go, what he should do, and he was so fearful about literally getting out of jail because he knew that his possibility to reoffend was huge. So, you know, my heart goes out to our veterans like that, and for our prisoners getting out, knowing full well if they don't get the treatment, they're going to be back again. So, you know, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but, you know, I just wanted to piggyback on that we've got to do something better. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis, and thanks for working with the gentleman. We're all working with the same issues with the same people. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a question on treatment for Mr. Jesse.
Question on treatment for Mr. Jesse, and then a question on land. So the question on treatment, Jeff, I think I've asked this question almost every year, but there's certainly a lag between the amount of treatment available in the state and the number of people who need it. And I think there's a growing recognition in this legislature that that's not a cost savings. So one of the difficulties is, and I'm wondering if you have it, on two subjects. Number one, do you have any measurement for us on what the state or state in conjunction with you or the private sector would need to do to raise the level of available treatment to the level of people who need it? Is there any measurement like that? And the second question on treatment is specifically on heroin addiction. I do know that in many communities there is not available heroin addiction treatment, and all those people do is when they're turned away, they go out and commit a felony and make their drug dealer more powerful. So that doesn't seem like a good policy. So both in general and on heroin addiction treatment, what's the lag there and how much of the need are we meeting there?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, as far as the overall unmet need, we don't have an effective system to determine that. Many agencies, if not most, don't keep a wait list, so you don't know how many people have even come to them and asked for services. So we don't know what that lag is, but we know it's substantial because, as Representative Gaddis pointed out, we know of so many individuals that have sought treatment and haven't been able to access it. And, of course, the key is to find, A, the most efficient way to have people get access to treatment, which is why we're looking at primary care and some of these more cost-effective systems than having all standalone siloed types of programs, and a funding mechanism. Again, I know people differ in their thoughts about this, but Medicaid expansion is a huge, huge piece of that. I mean, if you think about, well, let's see, single individuals between 18 and 65 that don't have very much money. Boy, that sure sounds like people coming out of prison, and it is. Thousands of them are going to be eligible under that. As far as the heroin issue, we're chasing that. It's getting worse every day. You know, I think there's work to be done along the entire continuum, starting with physicians and how they prescribe opioids. And more important than how they prescribe them is how they work with their patients to get them off of the opioids successfully. So I think that's a huge issue. And then, of course, even the treatment community is chasing the capacity issue as well.
Thank you. And then I'll follow up more on that later. Then just on the lands issue, if I could ask, I'll say it out front. I'm not a big fan of giving you the most controversial lands and telling you to go deal with them and make money on them. The one that comes to mind is the Chewitna mine, which is now yours to deal with. Many of us know the pros and cons of that project. The litigation costs, the permitting costs, all of the costs in defending the opposition to it from fishermen, village residents, do you have to pay any of those, or is DNR covering all of that? Is that part, the controversy part, the litigation part, the permitting part, the opposition part, does that cost you money, or is that something that the DNR pays for?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, as the landholder, we have a lessee who is pursuing the mine, and if we are a party to a lawsuit or something along those lines, we would bear that cost. Otherwise, that is not our cost to bear. We're not a permitting agency. We're just the landowner.
Has it cost you money, the Chuitno mine, at all in terms of any of the litigation, permitting, regulatory stuff that's being battled on that project?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, yes, we have both through staff time and resources as well as interaction with the Attorney General's office had some significant costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I don't want to get too deep into issues like that today. Well, if we can, just because we've got the HES budget coming, but I certainly want members to ask all the questions they need to ask. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. And thanks, Jeff, for serving on the Criminal Justice Commission. Appreciate that work. And it's really important that we see the value in the continuum. So my question has to deal with that. We've got Senate Bill 91. We've got a lot of criminal justice reforms coming through. Sort of in tandem, and one of them is really just to, because we see a rising corrections budget, a lot of options like supervised release and things like that. And I'm wondering if you can give an analysis on whether the health side of the stuff the Trust does, the stuff DHSS does, is going to be prepared for the folks that come out of the prison system, because we're really pushing fast on that part of it, but I don't think we're pushing as hard on the once they're out, what happens to them, and how do we prevent the recidivism when they're out?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair. Well, actually, the department and the trust and many others are working pretty darn hard on that end. That's one of the things that having the current administration in the department so positive in terms of working with the other agencies is really helpful. I mean, in fact, just the other day at the Criminal Justice Commission, we were lamenting the fact that Health and Social Services doesn't actually have a seat on the commission. And so I think that's a reflection of how the commission members themselves understand how important that relationship is. And when you have a department that's actually trying to help, even when some people would say it's not necessarily in their wheelhouse, that's when you start to really get the kind of collaboration that you need to get something done, and we've got to get something done.
And so follow. So you think, I mean, you've just said the collaboration seems to be there, and that you believe that if these bills that pass on sentencing reforms and supervised release pass, that the HES department and you will be able to take up that part. That sort of slack that's out.
Well, Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, you also need to pass a Medicaid reform bill.
Yeah. Thank you. And then I have another question on the land office.
Representative Kawasaki.
On the land office, one of the last slides about acquiring income-generating real estate, can you explain the income-generating real estate? Is it like housing in the state? Is it like the permanent fund, where the permanent fund has shopping centers in Virginia?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, yes, it is solely focused on out-of-state acquisitions of a variety of different institutional-grade real estate.
Thank you. Mr. Morrison, can you get us a report on what you're doing over at the land management office, how much land you have, what you're leasing it out, kind of a basic structure on a full report, how much land you have for sale, what you expect to sell, what you've sold, a little bit so we know more about how that office operates. And again, probably separate but connected to that, Representative Guerra, if we can get a report on the Chulitna project, what costs have you got into it? What cost do you expect, and how much revenue do you expect to get back on that to make sure that you're not doing projects that end up in the red? So if we get it, since that was asked for, let's get the backup on that one. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Kochar. I was sitting here studying for my question, thinking I was further down the line, but I'd like to commend your approach today. I think tailoring your presentation around building a sustainable budget is speaking our language, and I think that's a very wise approach, and I appreciate having the board members here. And I appreciate having my mic closer to my mouth. in terms of the composition of the inmate population these days, about three-quarter of them are in the non-violent sort of the pie chart, if you will. Can you tell me if some 60-some-odd percent of all of the prison population has some form of mental illness? Of those three-quarters in the non-violent part, how much of that population is afflicted with some kind of mental health challenge?
I can tell you that we had a report done to look at the inmate population. We'll be happy to provide you with that report, which will give you lots of details about the trust beneficiaries. In terms of, I don't recall off the top of my head the percentage, or if it was broken out by violent versus nonviolent offenders. I think it was primarily broken out misdemeanant versus felon. But I can tell you from personal experience, I have a background. I was a probation officer some 35 odd years ago. I'm married to a district court judge who runs the mental health court in Anchorage, and I hear on a daily basis from her about the population that she sees, and I can assure you that a good many of virtually all of the population in the mental health court, of course, are trust beneficiaries. But even beyond the mental health court, those who are just in the regular system, the regular court hearings, many of those are trust beneficiaries. The vast majority of those are nonviolent offenders. And as pointed out in some of these recent reports, we've had nonviolent offenders held in corrections for lengthy periods of time, sometimes awaiting a competency evaluation. Sometimes they are held longer in corrections awaiting an evaluation than they would be held if they were actually sentenced to a crime, for a crime. It's a problem. It's a significant problem. I can't give you the exact number, but there is no question that we are holding nonviolent trust beneficiaries in corrections. Our beneficiary population, I think I said earlier, the felons spend twice as long in prison as who are beneficiaries, spend twice as long as non-beneficiaries. For misdemeanants, I believe they spend 2.5 times as long in jail as non-beneficiaries. So it's a significant portion, again, of the overall corrections population and the overall cost.
And Representative Edgman, to the chair, a large number of those nonviolent offenders are in for drug or alcohol offenses. And what the country has learned the hard way is you cannot imprison your way to solving the addiction and the war on drugs. That's not working. And it's really expensive. So, yeah, there are a lot of people with nonviolent offenses that are addicts, and prison isn't helping them.
Mr. Chair, if I might just one more question.
Representative Edgman.
We placed a fair amount of emphasis on Medicaid expansion and the value it provides to your organization. I think that's pretty well established. But in terms of increasing your reach and being able to provide services, can you just elaborate a little bit about what, bringing those beneficiaries in from 18 to age 65, I think it's up to 138% federal income or whatever it is. But can you just talk a little bit about how that makes your services stretch further?
Yeah, Representative Edgman, through the chair. Yeah, absolutely. Those people that are now eligible were unresourced. And when they go to a community mental health center or a substance abuse treatment provider, what they run into is a provider that says, look, I only get so much grant money. I lose money on every Medicaid in person that I serve. I mean, that's something that has also been a problem. And I have to use some of my grant money to subsidize the low Medicaid reimbursement rate. Well, by the time you look at that business model, how many totally unresourced individuals can you bring into service? The answer is not very many. And so by having those people be eligible for what amounts to health insurance, that allows providers now to have a payment source to start to build the capacity that we need in order to serve folks. And particularly around the criminal justice reform, those were the folks that, you know, here they are, so many of them are in there because of addiction and these problems. And yes, corrections has started to rebuild their treatment programs while they're in prison. But when they get released, if there's no follow-up, if there's no support for recovery, how long are they going to be successful at staying in the community? And again, if you look at that definition of the expansion population and you overlay that on the people that are coming out of prison, it doesn't take very long to figure out, well, that's the same group. And that's the group that we had to resource in order to have the capacity to do justice reinvestment.
Thank you. We have Representative Wilson, Munoz, and Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we talked a little bit about assessments being done, and they're done down the line versus at the beginning, at pretrial. And more of these is maybe information you could just get back to the co-chairs that they could get to us. You know, if you could tell us how much is already being spent on assessments down the line and how that's being followed up on, whether or not they're getting treatment, you know, how are they, you know, assessing whether or not, you know, those things have been met, so we can kind of get an idea how many more would be needed, you know, in pretrial. I think that would definitely help. If also you could get us what's already happening in the jails as far as treatment. I know for Fairbanks it's kind of a holding tank. Until you actually get sentenced, do you then go to some more permanent place where the treatment is? There's very little treatment I know in Fairbanks as far as the jail itself goes, but I could be wrong. So if we could just get what treatment and how many people there are and how they kind of, do you just get a certificate or do they follow along so we have it? And my last question, Mr. Chair, is how does it pertain to OCS? How many of your clients are mixed up in the OCS process? And I would bet if, from what I've learned in the last year, probably over 80% are there. And I'm not sure whether, you know, another area I don't think we talk about a whole lot, about the treatment portion of it and whether or not they're getting really treatment that matches the issue or just treatment so that we can check a box and say it happened and then talk about throw everything back in and not necessarily with a follow-up. But, you know, I'm not sure how the Mental Health Trust, how that works with the families and that treatment and whether or not there's anybody following up with that clientele, because I'm going to say no. I mean, we deal with cases every day, and I've never heard anybody about dealing, you know, talking to anybody from the Mental Health Trust, and I've never put anybody there, so maybe I need better education on better access, but that's not your jail group. That's your families are trying to hold together, that we've torn apart, and once you tear them apart, kind of just the same thing as jail, trying to put them back together, it's really difficult, so I guess I need help to understand how the trust works with that population who's also competing, again, with a very limited amount of mental health treatment that's provided in the state. But unless we've got some way to keep track, it's going to be really hard to try to figure out where those dollars need to go. And that has nothing to do with Medicaid expansion or the reform of that. This group qualifies already. It's just, are they getting the help necessary? And have you looked at that population?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I'll try to answer your question as best I can. I have a little background in that particular area as well. I was a child protection social worker at one time. I was a director of the agency at one time. It's been a long time ago now. Yes. You mentioned the figure of 80%. I think one time we did a look at the cases that we had, And approximately 80% of the cases involved a substance use disorder on the part of the parent or caretaker. As you say, most of those are the children's mental health absolutely is covered with Medicaid, and they get help. Many of the parents also have Medicaid coverage, not all. But the capacity issue is the big problem. Do we have the capacity to provide treatment for the parents when they need it, when they will actually accept it? And can we give them the right kind of treatment that they need? I can tell you from my past experience, we do not have the capacity to do that. I don't now know the figures of how long kids are in out-of-home care, but I know it used to be much, much too long, and that is an expensive proposition as well. So, yes, you're absolutely right. Many of those kids end up both in the juvenile justice system and ultimately in the adult criminal justice system. And I've seen literally that from the very beginning of a child's formative years through the juvenile justice system to the adult system. I've personally seen that. I know it happens, and it happens a lot.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
And it's kind of a request, I guess, to the board. We spend a lot of money of having our parents in court just to make another check off when nothing truly is happening. And I think we're already spending the money, so I don't think it's finding more money. I think we're not spending the money we have smartly. And if we weren't having, you know, to have the courts and the public defenders and the AG's office and everybody else just to say that, oh, well, we're not getting anywhere. But yet we put that into the services. But I think it needs somebody looking at the, because it's we don't have anybody for the parents. This is the Office of Children's Services, not the Office of Parent Services. And so the parents don't have that advocate. And I think since many of them, most likely if you really did a hard look like we have for corrections, and nothing against criminals, but I mean, these are parents who are doing their best, you know, I think it's time that we put a little focus there, because I think it ties it all together, like you just said, but if we're spending the money and we're just not doing it in the right places and we can stop this trend, then we win in all these avenues. And so I know you guys have a plate full, but I would greatly appreciate if there was any possibility this could be on your radar.
It is.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Webb and others.
Just Dr. correct Moden. Everyone's misimpression. I am not a doctor.
Okay.
I'm just Webb. A regular human being.
Well, thank you for your service and your work on these issues. You mentioned a case in Anchorage where an individual was murdered in prison. He is a person that I grew up with. He grew up here in Juneau and attended school right across the street at the Capitol School. And there were a number of failures that happened in his case, one after another. And so I feel compelled to point some of those out for the record. The first is, as you said, he should have never been held in prison. He was picked up for loitering in front of the bus station in Anchorage. And he was held in prison for 2 weeks before his family was contacted, his guardian, his legal guardian. He was murdered the next day. In addition to that, prior to that failure, he was in stable housing up until the state of Alaska shut down the group home where he was living, and then did not follow him into other housing, into a new placement. So I feel like certainly in his case, there were multiple failures. And you mentioned, I think Jeff mentioned the importance of having follow through. This case clearly illustrates that importance. And
As I Representative Munoz, through the chair, as I mentioned earlier, I hear about these cases as it happens. Both the victim and the perpetrator had been through my wife's mental health court. She knew them intimately. She was the judge who ordered I believe, the competency evaluation on the gentleman who I believe was the perpetrator. That was a heartbreaking case, as you point out, multiple both failures and lack of capacity. Both of those people were in jail in many respects because they both lost their housing.
Is that it?
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Gutberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The study and the work you're doing between what you're doing and the Justice Commission that we just heard from are going down a path I think is positive and giving us more tools to help us do what we do. And I think you're going in the right direction. But at some point, and I'm just wondering if anybody else has already gotten there, is there some analytical tool that will tell us, and it wouldn't be a straight number, obviously, but what is the optimum place we can go to where we're not, where we do treatment one place and it doesn't pop up another place? I mean, it always will, but how many people can we keep out of jail by giving so many treatments and not having to build more jails and not having to have more community violence and safer streets because of all these people? Is there some program out there that shows us that we're moving in the right direction, or that there's an optimum number of people getting treatment, people, that whole world of things? Because at some point when we cut corrections or we cut treatment programs, it pops up someplace else. And maybe it's just our communities are not safer, and we have to increase the public safety budget, you know, or things like that. But is there some optimum world where there's a report that says here it is somewhere in this vicinity is the appropriate range where things will get the maximum number of things will get covered?
I can't tell you that there is such a report. If it existed, my guess is we would not be able to afford to buy it because it would have essentially all the answers. But what you're pointing out really is that everything is a balance. We are balancing public safety with the cost of creating public safety. We've done that over the years, again, based on my own career, over a 35-year period. We put all of our eggs in the basket of confinement and punishment to achieve public safety. Government is risk averse, as you know. It's hard to take a chance, and it's much easier if you're a district attorney to recommend the harshest penalty, be tough on crime, recommend that someone not get bail, because it protects you. You've advocated for public safety. We're trying to get smarter in how we do business by assessing actual risk that people present in the Criminal Justice Commission, and you'll hear more about this. There are tools available to assess risk and try to allow you to find the ways to mitigate that risk. I don't know that we can put an absolute cost on achieving that balance, but I'm happy for the trust to try to seek to find the answer that to the question that you've posed. I know other states have undertaken similar kinds of reforms in their systems. We'll look into that. Texas is certainly one who's done a lot of it, and we'll see if there's any information out there to bring to bear on this.
Thank you. And Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, there's no easy button on this stuff, but there are ways. What you're looking for is the sweet spot where your investment is getting you a return that you're looking for, but you don't want to throw a lot of money at the very last piece. I mean, bring the kids home is a good example. We still have 100 kids out of state. Well, why do we still have 100 kids out of state? Well, we got to the point where the cost of developing services for that very specialized population at the inn was just prohibitive. And so we'll be looking for the same sweet spot in these reforms as well, because you don't, you know, it's like fraud. I had a conversation with Senator Michiki about Medicaid fraud. Well, how much is there? And how much will it cost to root it out? Well, you could spend $100 million and you won't find the last fraudulent claim. So how do you find that sweet spot where your investment is returning what you're looking for? And that's what we'll have to do with treatment. No, we can't afford to provide treatment to everybody all the time whenever they want it. That's not happening. But what makes sense to invest because you're getting a positive return on that investment? And quite frankly, at the stage we're at right now, it's not really a very relevant question because we're not close enough. But we're going to get close enough. And if we keep watching the data and keep analyzing the results, I think we'll know, like we did with Bring the Kids Home. We'll know and you'll know when we get to that point of diminishing returns, and you've done what you can and should do, and you can move on to OCS problems.
Just to follow through, Mr. Chair. You know, many times we just see examples like this by tracking two or three individuals. You know, here's a person here's two people that have this condition. Here's one that got treatment. Here's one that never did. You know, we see those in a lot of cases, the court time, the jail time, the recriminalization process. And I'm very aware there is no sweet spot. There is no easy answer here. But the more things, examples we have that make those decisions here, just make it, could focus us on it with doing the right thing. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. So thank you, members. I just have one more question before we wrap up, and then we do have to get to the Health and Social Services meeting. Jeff, the legislature does fund behavioral health programs for drug and alcohol treatments. Congress funds those programs. The trouble is getting the money that is funded for them to the street, in my opinion. We have behavioral health programs that do not even apply for the grants that we fund because of the amount of paperwork that they have to do. They cannot even amortize their cost for the value of that grant because of the amount of paperwork. We talked to the hospitals. We've all talked to these different organizations that offer this. And the biggest, the majority of the discussion is the amount of paperwork that they have to do to try and comply. Am I wrong in this surmising this? I mean, if we could get rid of, I'm going to say, half the regulations that we've got, I don't know what that number is, but are we strictly impeding the amount of flow of funds getting to the clients that need behavioral health services because of too much regulation?
Representative Newman, absolutely you're correct. We know that there's too much required. And yes, we need accountability, but we need to let people get on with their job and get the outcomes we want, not chase them around for the paperwork part of this to the point where we're spending too much money, time and effort on that and not on delivering service. The department did ask Tom Chard from the Behavioral Health Association and Kate Burkhart, the executive director of the Mental Health Board and the Alcohol Board, to look at that, and they came up with a good list of recommendations for some changes in that area. I'm not sure where the department is in looking at all those things, but we're not giving up on that. That has to be a piece of, and is in fact going to be a piece of the behavioral health redesign, piece of the larger Medicaid redesign, because part of getting the biggest bang for your buck is getting, again, we're talking a lot about sweet spots, but what is that sweet spot where you've got enough accountability that you can be assured you're getting what you're paying for, and yet not so much that you're impeding the actual outcome that you were trying to achieve? And so we're going to keep pounding away at finding that, and I think the department is positive about doing that as well. So again, you know, having a willing partner at the department is just a huge piece of the puzzle that we haven't always had. So I think we're going to have to get there.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Trust has been a big part of Alaska in what they do in delivering services to some of Alaska's most needed, and the work that you do is certainly respected. With that, we're going to take a short brief at ease here while we set up for the Budget Finance Subcommittee, and for the members, because we're a subcommittee as a whole for Health and Social Services, we'll work till 3:30 on the budget overview, and then we will adjourn at 3:30, and Representative Saddle will take it up at the next budget overview meeting. So with that, we'll take a brief at ease. Good afternoon. This portion of this meeting, we're going to hear from the Department of Health and Social Services, presenting an overview of the Department of Health and Social Services. With that, Commissioner.
Hoyana, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Nuhal Qamisha Magnan, Valerie Davidson, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, and I'm joined today at the table with by Sana Eford, Assistant Commissioner for Finance and Management Services. And we are really appreciate the opportunity to present the department's overview in furtherance of our mission to promote and protect the health and well-being of Alaskans. So we realize that we are short on time today. A lot more detail will also be provided as we drill down with the divisions as they come before the subcommittee as well. We did want to provide a couple of new staff changes. I wanted to introduce Deputy Commissioner for Family, Community, and Integrated Services, Karen Forrest, who is here today. On the phone, we have the new Director of Juvenile Justice, Rob Wood. Karen previously was in that role as Director of Juvenile Justice, so is no stranger to this committee. We have a new acting director of behavioral health is Randall Burns, who is also on the phone. The new director, she was previously acting director of the Pioneer Homes, is Vicki Wilson, and she is also on the phone. And finally, in person, we have a new director of public assistance, Sean O'Brien, who is here today as well. Other folks you know, Deputy Commissioner John Sherwood, Dr. Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer and Public Health Director, is on the phone. And I think in the interest of time, I'm just going to, my apologies to folks I didn't introduce personally. We have 8 divisions in the department. The Alaska Pioneer Homes, Vicki Wilson, I mentioned before, is the director. Their mission is really to provide the highest quality of life and a safe home environment for older Alaskans and veterans. Behavioral Health, Randall Burns is our acting director, and their mission is to manage an integrated and comprehensive behavioral health system based on sound policy, effective practices, and partnerships. Christy Lawton is here with us today, the director of the Office of Children's Services. And their mission is to prevent and respond to child maltreatment in order to ensure safe children and strong families. On the phone, Margaret Brody, the Director of Healthcare Services, their mission is to manage healthcare coverage for Alaskans in need. Also on the phone, Rob Wood, the Director of Juvenile Justice, and they really have several purposes. One is to hold juvenile offenders accountable for their behavior. The second is really to promote the safety and restoration of victims and communities, the second component. And the third is really to assist offenders as well as their families in developing skills to prevent crime. Also, Division of Public Assistance, Sean O'Brien, as I introduced earlier, their mission is to provide self-sufficiency and provide basic living expenses to Alaskans in need. The Division of Public Health, Chief Medical Officer and Director Dr. Jay Butler, really serve all of Alaskans. A mission is to protect and promote the health of Alaskans. Senior and Disability Services, Director Dwayne Mays, who's on the phone. Their mission is really to promote the independence of Alaska seniors and people who experience physical and developmental disabilities. And this graph is something that we've seen before. Yes.
Probably better for the committee if we go back to page 3. That was nice to go through the department heads and have their budgets underneath them, but we should probably look at those numbers as you go through them.
Sure.
Nice try, though.
Okay. My apologies, Mr. Chairman. I thought we were going to go through some of those details later on in the presentation, but we can certainly do that now as well. Okay. So Pioneer Homes represent about 2.3 of the Department of Health and Social Services FY16 operating budget, about $62 million, which includes about $35 million of UGF. Randall Burns, is that what you meant? Should I?
So just as we go through these, if members have questions on those different divisions within the departments, then we can ask.
Okay.
We know that we have a aging senior population. There's a waiting list to get into the Pioneer Homes. We know that the cost of medicine, medical services has gone up, starting to level off, hopefully. Do we expect the cost of operating the Pioneer Homes to increase due considerably because of that? Or is it going to start leveling off a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, we have seen an increasing level of acuity in the residents of our Pioneer Homes. I think in the early days, some folks who were there really needed level one services, which is really not much, not many services. These days, we are really seeing a trend for increased need for services, level two and level three. And one of the things that has happened in our state is because we don't really have a lot of other providers, or in fact hardly any other providers, who do Alzheimer's-related disorders. The Pioneer Home has really become, in many cases, the default Alzheimer's treatment centers in our state.
And because they go from level, they have the opportunity to stay within the home if they decide through, is there health to deteriorate to go from level one, two, three? If that does happen, they have the opportunity to stay in the Pioneer Home based on their income. So, cost for level three, $7,000 to $8,000 a month, I believe. Almost all covered by the state. Or kind of break that up a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, we can provide you with some more detailed information on the cost allocations for each level of care. But yes, those higher levels of care are more expensive. Typically, if we have somebody who is a level one resident, they may be there because they have a spouse in the facility who is at a level two or level three, and they may want to be as good, successful married couples do want to be living in the same place, but as their acuity develops, they will be moved into a higher level of care.
And Representative Sadler, I'm sure he'll get down into more of the details as he goes through the committee. Mm-hmm. Representative Wilson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We need numbers, too, because you have how many positions, but how many people are we serving in each one of the areas? I mean, you may not have that today, but it's and whether that's up or down, to just have a better understanding of what the population is showing.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, and we typically provide that as the Pioneer Home does their presentation. But I can add that to my list of things I should learn and implement for next year.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. In terms of healthcare services. 22 million dollars, and this piece is actually the administrative portion, I believe. $22 million, including $8.6 million in UGF, and this does not include the Medicaid. It's really the cost of administering that program. It does not include the Medicaid payments. Division of Juvenile Justice, $60.2 million. I guess I should round up, $60.3 million, of which $56.2 is in UGF and represents about a little over 2% of the operating budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, can you go back to the last page for a second? And certainly, it's only because I've seen this repeatedly at OC under presentations describing OCS, and it always talks about safe children, which is completely important. Strong families, maybe we can reunite the family, but in the mission also, it's I always feel like it should be safe and successful children, and sometimes I feel like there is the response to the crisis, which is necessary, but there's not the needed follow-through to then help with the success of the children. And that's a completely broad statement. OCS does a lot of work on all of those things, but it's always described as crisis, family retention, and we leave out successful children. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. Division of, did I skip OCS in my, I'm sorry, if I can go back. Clearly I'm working out the kinks at the very beginning of session. Office of Children's Services, $151.4 million, including $87.4 million in UGF, representing about 5.5% of the department's budget. Division of Public Assistance, $313 million, including $147 million of UGF, representing about a little over 11% of the operating budget. And much of these programs are actually federal pass-through programs. The Division of Public Health, about $134.7 million, including $49.6 million in UGF, represents about 5% of the operating budget. Senior and Disability Services represents about 2.7% of the budget and is about $73.5 million, including $48.6 million in UGF. I feel like my elementary math teacher would be thrilled of my ability to be able to round up on the fly here. I messed up on a couple of them. My apologies to my elementary math teacher. You know who you are. In terms of the service population, this really describes our priorities, our three main priorities in the department, which have actually been longstanding priorities of our department: health and wellness across the lifespan, healthcare access, delivery and value, and safe and responsible individual families and communities. And as you can see at the bottom, we really serve Alaskans from prenatal all the way to the end. And I know this, we get comments from folks, why do you say death at the end? Because that seems so fatal. But the truth is, we do, it's inevitable. It is inevitable. It happens to all of us, no matter the choices we make in our life. Sometimes it happens sooner than later. But we do also provide some burial assistance. So that's why that. I'm struggling with finding a more appropriate word, but we are certainly open to lots of recommendations. For the next several slides, I'm going to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Eford to discuss some of the more of the details of the budget.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sana Eford. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Finance and Management Services for the Department of Health and Social Services. What I have, the next few slides are just shown to be illustrative of the process that we have been going through, which most of you have been along this journey with us for the last few years, especially the last 2 years, 2.5 to 3 years. This is shown to illustrate the process the department has gone through to actually examine and look at the programs and the activities within each of the divisions and determining how those programs actually fit and align to each of the three priorities and the seven core services that the department has identified as our mission and goals. Again, lots of information just to show that this, it breaks it out, as you'll notice in the top, each priority by funding source, each core service by funding source, and then as you go down, the teardrops, as they're turned this way, I think Craig Holt refers to them as candle wicks when they go the other way, but each teardrop is representative of one of the divisions, and under that division, how their budget aligns to each of the core services. The next, again, is just to show from FY15 budget to the FY16 budget by priority. And these are total funds, not separated by general funds or other funds. But in total, the department's budget went down $75.3 million. And there you can see how that was broken out among the three priorities for the department. The next step, which is, or the next slide, show kind of the next piece of the journey that the department has been on this past year. So, as we talked about, the department originally focused on making sure that all of the pieces of our divisions, programs, and activities aligned in some way to help achieve the mission and the priorities and the core services for the department. The next piece. I'm sorry. My teacher voice always comes out. I'll try to sit back. Can you hear me? Okay. So the next piece illustrates the next part of the journey for the department is establishing what are measurements, what are the department measurements that will roll up into each of the core the objectives, core services, and priority to give us a snapshot of how we're performing. So this is our first attempt at collecting that information in a way that we can visually display and show what we're doing. Again, I just have a couple of slides. This is not every slide. It does not incorporate all the measurements. And again, these are just department measurements that roll up. So what you see here is a very inexpensive software that we are trying to use to collect information to visually show where we stand with each of our performance measures toward our priorities and core services. So again, on the left-hand side, you see three dashboards, which represent the three priorities of the department, which the health and wellness across the lifespan, healthcare access and delivery, safe and responsible families and communities. Then across those, and you see the dashboard shows us red, yellow, green, how we're performing. The core service feeds into that dashboard. Under each of the core services, you see the objective. And then through this piece on down to the next, actually we have then which measurements feed into each of those dashboards to determine what the priority dashboard shows.
Anna, you are judging yourself on these priorities then?
Yes, this is what each, and again, I'm just showing department level, and I'm only showing an illustration. Each of the divisions will pull out some of their key measurements to show you and to report how they are performing. This is, again, another tool, the next step in what we're trying to do, to look at, okay, we've aligned our budget, here's where we've determined, here's how we say we want to spend our funds and what we want to achieve, how are we doing that, and what are the measurements we're using, and where is the data to collect that actually is giving us the true information that we can measure. So we're still at that stage of looking at where can we pull information from that actually shows us outcomes and doesn't show us that we're just counting number of people that come through the door.
Thank you, Representative Sandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Santa, I want to offer the opportunity or the invitation just to tell us where, when appropriate here, specifically the results-based budgeting has helped you set and manage your priorities better. And also, just to clarify, green, I think, is good. Yellow is needs improvement. And red is unacceptable. I just want to make sure I understand the gradation.
Yes, and again, this is this was our first attempt without spending a lot of money on a software that would help us have a point of collection for department measures. And so it's not as sophisticated as we would like it to be because it doesn't necessarily measure the efficiency measure, dollars. The balance of those is not necessarily exactly what we would like to have at our fingertips, but it's a starting place for us. Before we go on to the next, I will address Representative Sadler through the chair just a little bit about what the performance-based model has done for the department. And I've expressed this before. More than anything, it has given us a platform to speak from in one voice. And it shows each of the divisions, and actually as we're trying to push it down through our staff and trying to incorporate it into helping them understand how everybody's piece fits into helping the department achieve these priorities. It's given us that platform to talk, and it has created the cross-divisional conversations that have helped to look at, are we duplicating? Are there ways that we can support and leverage each other's programs or funding to help achieve what the whole department needs? So that's the biggest benefit that we've received at this point. And then also starting to collect on a department basis, not just by the individual silos, but how do all these pieces fit together to achieve the department goals?
So I think, Mr. Chair, Sana and I are going to share, I think, this slide. The first highlight of the budget change in 2016 is Medicaid expansion. Wanted to provide the committee with just a little bit of updated information on where we are. Through the end of December, 7,957 Alaskans were enrolled through expansion. As we predicted, more men enrolled than women, about 4,267 men. Versus 3,690 women. The total claims that had been paid through December were about $21.6 million in claims, and again, those are 100% federal receipts. Someone did ask me the other day, I thought that number was going to be much larger. We do expect it to be larger. Under federal Medicaid rules, there is a one-year timely filing limit, so providers who provide services to Medicaid beneficiaries have actually up to a year to be able to bill for services that they have provided. By region, and the information that I'm sharing today, we're cleaning up so that we can provide it on our website in the interest of transparency, giving the public better information about our Medicaid beneficiaries and where folks live, what kind of services they're accessing, etc. In the way that we count Medicaid beneficiaries, I know has been the topic of conversation many times and before this committee, because, and the truth is, it can be really difficult to manage because people come on and come off of Medicaid constantly throughout the year. Somebody may get a job, which is a great thing, and they are no longer qualifying for Medicaid. Someone may lose their job and suddenly qualifies for Medicaid. So at the end of the year, we can look at, you know, how many unduplicated Alaskans were covered by Medicaid, and it will typically be a higher number, like, you know, around 148,000 Alaskans. At the end of the year, unduplicated Alaskans. But if you look at a point in time, for example, in December, 129,366 Alaskans were enrolled in Medicaid, including the expansion population. It's no surprise that the largest Medicaid population exists in the Anchorage and Mat-Su, followed by the Interior, Southwest, Gulf Coast, Southeast, and then Northern Alaska. And as I said before, we will post this information on our website. About the majority of our beneficiaries are children. 54% of our Medicaid beneficiaries are children. An additional 2% are children who experience disabling conditions. Right now, 6% is through expansion. 6% are seniors, 21% are parent caretakers, and 11% are adults who experience disabling conditions. And we will roll that out so that we can, and it will be refreshed monthly on our website so that we can provide that level of detail as well. In terms of the Pioneer Homes, Rate increase is proposed to take effect on February 1st, 8.5%. It is the first time that the Pioneer Home rate has been increased in a number of many years, actually. We also have a request for letters of interest to the public to inquire if any organizations or companies are interested in taking over the management and operations of Pioneer Homes. We'll certainly report back what kind of interest that we get from that prospect. In terms of the Ketchikan youth facility, we recognize that we really, as you heard from the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, we really don't have enough treatment facilities in our state, especially for adolescents, certainly. And we are right now pursuing an opportunity with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to redesign and reprogram that facility so that we can provide more intensive services to youth throughout the state in that particular facility. In terms of the detention services that are provided there, that would of course mean that those individual youth who require detention would be transferred to the facility in Juneau.
Thanks for taking a look at the privatization of Pioneer Homes. And you and I in the past have had discussions about juvenile justice centers where applicable in rural areas where they would maybe fit into the tribal envelope. Been a movement to try and move more civil cases over to tribal. Could you talk about where we're at in that?
I almost said through the chair. Mr. Chairman, those conversations with tribal organizations continue, but the truth is we are in the very preliminary stages. I know that in Senator Kelly's Medicaid reform bill, Senate Bill 74, it is a directive to the department to explore privatizations of DJJ facilities. I know that the facility in Nome, through Norton Sound Health Corporation, has expressed interest in operation of that facility. But one of the things that we certainly have the opportunity to do is take advantage of, for the benefit of beneficiaries as well as for the state, really realize those savings for 100% federal match when a IHS beneficiary or Alaska Native or American Indian, like me, who is also a Medicaid beneficiary, receives their care through an IHS facility, those are considered the 100% federal match. Now, on that point, I do want to highlight one, it's kind of an earth-shattering development, if I may. Last year, I know I'm showing my ultra nerdiness by being excited about Medicaid policy, but man, this is good stuff. Last year, Governor Walker sent a letter to Secretary Burwell inquiring about 1115 waiver opportunities to really position the state to better partner with tribal health organizations to be able to take advantage of 100% federal match. Now, one of the challenges we have had is we've got the IHS beneficiary covered, we've got the Medicaid beneficiary covered, but the real challenge has been what is considered through an IHS facility. And historically, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, the feds, have said travel and accommodation services are not covered at 100%. They're really 50%. And services that are referred beyond the tribal health system's capacity to provide that care are also not through an IHS facility and therefore are at 50% federal match or their appropriate corresponding match, slightly higher for children. The pitch that we made was we would like to do an 1115 waiver that would allow 100% for travel and accommodation services because we feel that is a critical access to care issue and the beneficiaries don't have that access if they don't have that that travel and accommodation service. We also said that if it is beyond the tribal health system's capacity to provide that care. Let's say somebody goes from A&M, goes to A&MC, but they can't provide the service there and it has to be transferred to Providence or Alaska Regional. That really, since it began and originated in a tribal health facility, they should also be considered 100% federal match. Secretary Burwell sent a letter to Governor Walker that was actually delivered on Air Force One by President Obama that said, we're probably not going to be able to get there through an 1115 waiver, which was a concern because one of the things that 1115 waivers require is budget neutrality for the federal government. And, of course, in an effort to refinance so that they pick up more of the costs, it's not budget neutral for them. And so what she said instead was, we'll change national policy to be able to accommodate that, not only for Alaska, but also 34 other states that have significant tribal presence. And so for us in Alaska, that is probably our biggest opportunity for saving. So we are continuing to negotiate with CMS about what exactly does that mean, what are the rules, when can we expect to implement, and what are our opportunities for savings. And certainly we will do our best to see if there's any opportunity to retroactively apply that policy. There's no shame in my game for asking for that as well. But that really is a tremendous opportunity for our state. I know that South Dakota is also pursuing that aggressively because it means tremendous opportunities for their state as well. So we are very fortunate that we have a really great working relationship with CMS in which to explore many of these opportunities. And the truth is, when I worked in tribal health, I worked in tribal health for 15 years, and we tried to get that for the entire 15 years that I worked in tribal health, and we were a little stunned when the letter came through. Sana, can I turn to you to speak to the reduction in senior benefits programs?
Yes. So the next budget change that happened in 16 was a reduction to the senior benefits program. There was about a $2.6 million reduction. The senior benefit has three levels of payments, $125, $175, $250, with three different income levels. This reduction will be taken to the highest income level, therefore the lowest payment level of $125, and it will affect probably currently at that lowest payment level, we have about 5,348 seniors.
And, Santa, what's the cost on that per year with the changes that you're making currently?
Well, in the current program, we have about $20 million in the senior benefits program now for 17.
$20 million, and this will bring it down to?
No, there was 22. I don't have the exact, but about $22.6 million in it, and we have about this reduction that was taken in 16, so we currently have $20 million, and the governor has that same proposed number in 17.
Representative Gumberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Pioneer Home rate increase, is that basic? I hope it's basically you can charge more and get reimbursed more. Is there any impact on the population?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. So the way we will bill residents of the Pioneer Home for that rate increase, typically it can be billed to insurance, it can be billed to Medicaid, it can be billed to self-pay. If a person is self-pay, we also have a sliding fee scale that we can work with the individual. But if your question is, are we going to throw folks out on the street? No.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Chair.
Mr.
Thank you. But just to be clear, there are people who self-pay, and so that 8.5%, they will pay that increase, right?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes, that is correct. We want to really thank, and Guyana Jaknak, thank you so much to this committee for the additional positions in the Office of Children's Services to be able to address our increase in utilization for children who need out-of-home services and help with working with their families. We did want to give you a little bit of an update on where we are in filling those positions. 13 of those PCNs have been filled. An additional 10 will be filled within the next 30 days. And then we have an additional 3 that will be filled within 60 days. We were able to transfer 2 other positions interdepartmentally to be able to actually bring an additional 2 positions, so a total of 28 additional positions to be able to address this need.
You already have the funds in hand for all the equipment that they're going to need, office space and such, computers.
We do currently at this time feel that we have the resources to fund the position, the computer and technology needs for these staffers.
Governor Wilson.
Thank you. And I just have some questions so you can just get the answers back because you probably don't have them now. Of those positions, could you let us know how many of them are caseworkers versus social workers? Mm-hmm. In what areas are they located? How many families does each caseworker now have? We hear the overstaffing, but I've looked in between children and families, it's hard to really distinguish since many families have more than one. And just a clarification on the reunification rate back to the parents. I know most of the reunification I've seen has been not just to the parents, but maybe to a family member. But in my opinion, that's not really reunification. It's better than necessarily not having a family member, but when you're really trying to track how many children and families are put back together, I wanted to make sure that we're right on those rates. So if you could just get those to us, that would be great.
Ms. Thompson.
Thank you. These 26 positions were funded with some federal money that came in. And there was an indication at that time that this federal money for this particular program might not continue into the future. Is there any indication from the federal government if this funding will continue to pay for these 26 positions?
Representative Thompson, through the chair, the original, there was a number of different changes throughout the budget process. What happened with OCS in conjunction, really, again, I can kind of point back to the whole performance-based and how the conversations have been happening across divisions. But in conversation from with OCS and DPA, some temporary assistance for needy family funds were identified that could be used to cover the Child Advocacy Center's funding that goes out from the department. That is that was the federal funds that were identified at that time that we were going to be able to use our general funds. Then the general funds were cut in one scenario, but then they were added back. So these positions were actually, there's a small amount of federal funds associated with the positions that we can collect. But the federal dollars that were identified were actually the TANF funds that now can be used for the Child Advocacy Centers. And we do not anticipate that that will be reduced in the next few years. We have no indication of that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Guerra. Last question for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so the committee knows, and so I have my numbers straight, so we made some progress in trying to cut down the caseloads last year, added those 26 OCS positions. The number of children in the system by last year had risen to 2,500 from 1,700-something. But since that, it's up to 2,800 now. Is that correct? And it's actually...
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, you are correct. We are now at over 2,800 children in.
So we need to wrap up.
Yeah, I just wanted folks to know if they did it.
I'm sure you'll be back with it. Thanks. With that, again, before we get into the budget request from the governor's office, Representative Thompson.
Thank you. I think we'll be continuing with the governor's request with Health and Social Services during subcommittee.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Sorry we ran out of time today. But tomorrow, Thursday, January 28th, we'll be meeting here in this room at 9 a.m. We'll have the Sovereign Wealth Funds and Rule-Based Resource Revenue Management Global Trends, Challenges, and Best Practices Overview. This will be by Milan Retvelt. He's the Managing Director of Retvelt Consultancy Incorporated. That will be at 9 a.m., and then we will meet tomorrow afternoon at 1:30 p.m. here in this room. We'll be going through the Department of Public Safety and Department of Education and Early Development budget overviews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, we will call it a day. Thank you.
Thank you.